Hello, and welcome to the February 27th, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is soulful, jazz-tinged, and sometimes a little bit country, Americana singer-songwriter Nina DeVitri. To listen to Nina DeVitri is to take a deep breath at the end of a hard day, weaving together the strands of her stories with a dynamic alto voice and inventive yet memorable melodies. She manages to create a sound that is both soulful and refreshingly unique. DeVitri began pursuing songwriting and production professionally when she wrote, recorded, and produced her first extended play at the age of 20 years old. Entitled Trust a Dream, the extended play is a love letter to intuition and its power to change your life for the better. Steeped in the legacy of songwriters like Nora Jones and Sarah Bareilles, DeVitri's early songs reflect her natural inclination to swirl between the worlds of roots and jazz. With her music, she lovingly delivers a message of optimism and trust, encouraging all who cross her path to look inward and align themselves with the paths they dream of taking. Her songs lounge on the fence between genres, transcending their bounds and honoring the sheer variety and depth of her musical training and inspirations. Her debut full-length album, What You Feel Is Real, showcases her exceptional ability to meld multiple inspirations into a cohesive sonic scape. The album is a lesson in holding dualities without conflict. It brings forward messages of hope while also affirming that the darkness and hardships that face us are still challenging and painful. In expressing these ideas, DeVitri provides both validation and catharsis. Listening to her makes you feel seen as you are, giving you the strength to let go of the burdens that hold you down. From staccato drum snaps and bright, emphatic horns to dreamy piano fills and ethereal pedal steel, DeVitri takes the listener on a journey of the heart on What You Feel Is Real. At its core, the album is a plea to open one's heart to oneself, to others, and to the world. At the beginning of the album, songs like Wrong Thing and don't remind me. Acknowledge the human need to indulge in feelings that may not always completely serve us. The album then softens into themes of self-love and later expands into a series of love songs, one for her lover, one for her mother, and one for music itself. Devitri creates a distinct symmetry in the album in choosing a penultimate song quite similar in messaging to the opening song. If one's heart has not yet unfurled during the previous tracks, Open will coax it to a place of vulnerability with its sorrowful melody and lush strings. The closing song, the title track, is the icing on the cake, with a sobering story of the writer's betrayal of her own heart and a plea for listeners to trust that what they feel is real. Though she knows trusting one's heart can be a constant battle, Devitri hopes that the messages these songs carry can inspire self-love, mental health awareness, personal empowerment, and hope. Each song paints with a full palette, providing glowing red warmth and buttery yellow comfort, while refusing to shy away from the darkest shades of indigo and violet that give life its definition. Paired with the earthen smokiness of her voice, Devitri presents a microcosm of the universe in each song, and you won't want to look away. From her first memories of late night, old time, and bluegrass jams around campfires, listening to her dad play with his Django jazz band, and her years of training in classical violin and piano, Devitri has always been surrounded by song and inspiration. While she knows these vibrant and varied experiences shaped her path, she also knows that she, like all people, has a voice and a message that are uniquely hers to share. "Your creative voice just is," she says. "Once you start writing or making art, that voice shines through everything you create." Gifted with time and uncertainty during the COVID-19 pandemic, Devitri chose to slow down and focus on nurturing herself. Rather than prioritizing the output, she instead turned her gaze toward the process. She focused on exploring outlets for joy and self-expression outside of music, like experimenting in the kitchen, spending time in nature, and starting a Nashville musicians' soccer team. She reconnected with her deep love of the piano and began investing in her own growth as an instrumentalist. "What we feel is real," she says. "What we love is real. And I think the more we all trust these inner voices, the closer we will get to both knowing ourselves and knowing a more loving and peaceful society." Devitri's songwriting and musicianship have been recognized worldwide. She has twice been named a finalist in the jazz category of the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest. She has performed all over, from the smallest of private house concerts all the way to the stages of the Philly Folk Fest and Lancaster Roots and Blues. Now, with a 6-song extended play under her belt, international recognition, momentum as a songwriter, and her debut full-length album, it is safe to say that this is only the dawn of Nina Devitri's rising star. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Nina Devitri. Hello, Nina.
Hello.
It's really great to talk with you and have you as a guest on my show today. And we're very anxious to learn more about you and about your music.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm
you
really
bet. Your most recent album that I'm aware of is your 2023 recording, What You Feel Is Real. Let's strike while the iron's hot. Would you please tell us about this album?
Sure. So this album is 11 tracks that I recorded a few years back, and it was a true labor of love. It took me about 2 years from start to finish since we went into the studio and all the overdubs and arrangements and everything like that. It is my first full-length album, and it has a lot of different themes of like self-trust and self-love and following that inner intuition that can be so hard to trust sometimes, and showcases some stories from my life of times where I had to really learn to trust that gut feeling or got a little burned for not trusting it. But yeah, it has a lot of different styles of music on it. I'm a very, I would say, eclectic person in general, and that carries over into my music. I love so many different genres, so many different sounds, and so I feel like I shouldn't limit myself when I create music. I just put the sounds on that I think each song calls for. So.
Okay. Well, I would say that yes, listening to your recording, I received that same impression that you draw upon several different styles or genres of American music. For example, your song "History" is a straight up soul ballad. At least that's the way it sounded to me. And "Home" really had I think, a very strong tinge of country music in it. Especially, and maybe it's just because of the inclusion of the steel guitar. Because we often associate that either with country music or Hawaiian music. And it didn't make me want a hula, so I figured it must have been more of a country tinge. But then, surprise, surprise, we get down, let's see, is it like about the eighth or ninth track on the album? And Mother of Mine is just a straight ahead jazz swinger. And so I thought, okay. So here's someone who is multifaceted and is familiar with different styles of music. So my question for you in the creation of your art, would you talk about your musical palette, if you will? Now, what I mean by that is not your tastes, but when I used to teach students at the university about musical styles and colors, I used to say, well, a composer or a performer will have a palette, much like an artist has a palette, and it'll have different colors. And then they'll take their brush and they'll mix a little bit of this color with a little bit of that color to create a third, color. So when I say palette, thinking in terms of mixtures or even maybe focus on a particular color, whatever to meet your needs. But how do you choose to draw upon these different styles or colors to make your music?
Oh, I love thinking about music like painting and choosing from a palette. I've never quite thought about it in that way, and that's a beautiful comparison. Well, the short answer is that to me, every song that I write is, or songs in general, I think are something almost beyond the writer, like a creative idea that you catch hold of and nurture and you come up with a song in the end. And I feel like each song that I write has its own voice and calls for something very different. And so, for example, one of the songs in the album, Like You Could Be Living, the sixth track, and it has a little bit more of a like New Orleans style, some horns and stuff like that. And I wrote that originally on the guitar. And when I perform it just alone on the guitar, it just sounds like a stripped down song on the guitar. But I love producing because it gives you a chance to, elevate a song and add flair that someone might not originally hear. And the thing that ended up taking that song in a New Orleans direction, funny enough, is I was going to sleep one night and I thought about this Leon Bridges song, Coming Home, And I thought about that like smooth 6/8 ta 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 rhythm, and I thought, oh my gosh, that would really change this song for the better. And then once I added that on, I thought, well, now it sounds like a you'd walk into a bar in New Orleans and kind of hear people playing around and glasses tinkling, and let's add some horns. So that's just like a little microcosm example of how one song that I wrote on the guitar turned into, having a certain cultural flavor just because of an idea of a rhythm to add. And, that opened this whole door into, what horns I was going to add and everything like that. That being said, some of the songs right off the bat, they come out with a certain harmonic rhythm structure, like Don't Remind Me is that samba song, and I wrote that originally with that sort of bossa nova samba rhythm. I was studying in Spain at the time and listening to a lot of like Latin music, Brazilian music, and going out to the clubs and listening to all these amazing rhythms, and I think that found its way into that song. And the jazz song Mother of Mine, I think when I wrote that one's one of the oldest ones on the album actually. And I think I knew from the start, oh, I want this one to be more of a jazz ballad, because I do love jazz, and the chords that I was using, the voicings on the guitar really called for a swing behind it. So it's almost like the chord choices and the melodic choices end up calling for certain rhythms and rhythm patterns. And then that sort of informs where, what colors on the palette I'm choosing from and what colors are close to that. Okay, if this calls for a swing rhythm, then I'm gonna want a trumpet or a saxophone on there,
Well, see, I think one of the beauties about music is that it is a very plastic art form, and it can be molded and shaped. And I think about one of my bands. We do an arrangement. It's actually not an original arrangement. I borrowed it from a band out of New York called the Lucky Chops, which is a kind of a brass band that's made their, I guess they've made their fame playing in the subway, but nonetheless, they do an arrangement of the song "My Girl," but as a reggae song, and it is so cool how it works. And you change up the rhythm and the underpinnings. The harmony doesn't really change, but that rhythmic feel, and then you fit the melodic line on top, and that's pretty cool. But also, while you were talking, I happened to think about two classical composers just off the top of my head. One was Felix Mendelssohn, who when I would teach about him in my music appreciation class, I'd say, well, when he came from a wealthy German family, and he traveled quite a bit. And so instead of taking Polaroids or pictures or home movies of places he traveled to, he wrote symphonies that reflected the music or the spirit of the culture. So we have a his Scottish symphony, we have his Italian symphony, which reflect his travels there. Or I also thought about Tchaikovsky's Capriccio Italian, which opens with this trumpet fanfare because he ha just happened to be staying near a military installation, and so he would hear the trumpets or the bugles play the throughout the day to signal various things to the soldiers there. And to draw upon, they're consciously writing in a particular style, or writing a particular, trying to capture a particular motif because of the environment that they're in. So you've kind of partially already answered this. When you sit down to write a song, when you're initially inspired, do you consciously and with intent think of this? Okay, I'm going to write a soul ballad. I'm going to write a jazz a straight ahead jazz, or I'm going to write a Latin, you know, does it work that way? Or are these things that come after the initial inspiration?
You know, it has happened in different ways throughout my life, but I feel like the most common thing for me is I will sit down with a feeling, and I will start to play around on the instrument. And often it is like, I am an instrumentalist first before being a singer and a songwriter. So often I feel that it is the instrumental content and the harmony of the chords that bring out the story. And sometimes, you know, the most recent song that I wrote, it was like, sat down at the keyboard. I did think, okay, I want to write a groovier song because I knew I had to write something upbeat for a session coming up. Mm-hmm. So I had that in mind. But I ended up writing a kind of a slow song there at the piano. So sometimes the intent doesn't really get me anywhere because the song kind of just does its thing anyway.
Yeah.
To answer your question, it's often like the chords and the melody that flow out dictate where the song mm-hmm. goes. And usually like a line or a verse or something will come to me while I'm playing, but then I'll take some time and actually type out or write out like, okay, like how do I get this, this verbal story to stay strong and cohesive? Because I think there was a time where I wrote a little more like, oh, I'm just going to write whatever like lines come to me, you know, and I'm trying to find more structure in my mm-hmm. lyrics. So I'll take a moment away from the instrument then and do a little more like poetry writing, honestly, mm-hmm. once I found what the rhythm of the words is. That most recent song, it's interesting. I wrote it kind of slow, but then I came back to it later. I was like, okay, we could actually do that double time. We can make it groovy. Mm-hmm. And so it mm-hmm. did work out in the end. But it's funny, if I went back and listened to like different podcasts or different times people have asked me that question, I've probably given a slightly different answer every time.
Well, you know, it's sort of like, I know that's a difficult question. I always like to ask it anyway, because I'm interested in people's creative process. And I understand, I know how inspiration happens for me, and it is probably different for all of us, because you never know how or why your muse is going to spew, or what's going to, you know, turn the switch on. You know, for me, it's like sometimes I'll be listening to a whole nother piece of music, and all of a sudden I'll get an idea. There's just something about what I'm listening to that triggers something else in my mind. I kind of equate it to like, you know, when we go to look up something on the internet. And every time we start out looking for something, we find something that we weren't looking for. And then we end up going down that rabbit hole. And that's kind of where, you know, what then comes out. It often reminds me, too, when I was a university professor and a student would ask a question, and 20 minutes later, I'd say, now, what was your question again? You know, because we tend to bloviate. That's just the nature of the beast, you know, for those of us in academia. I think that it just never surprises me how different ways our minds work. And but typically what inspires you to write, and you can't say a deadline?
Well, I'll give another example here. Like something that inspired me recently was just a conversation with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Had this phone call, and the sort of what ended up being kind of the thesis of our call, like, you know, what we really went deep on, I call with this line in my head, which was, oh, like, we're here to love. And then I went and I sat down and ended up writing, you know, sort of a song with no chorus. It had several verses, almost like every section was the refrain, you know, it's very repetitive. And the craziest thing is I came back to that song in December and wrote a chorus for it, and it sort of solidified the real message of the song. It was almost like I didn't know the true meaning of it until a few months later it sort of hit me. So sometimes it's a conversation with a friend or just a feeling, like something happens to me and I am feeling it in my body and I'm like, I gotta process this emotion. Less often, but still sometimes I'll hear another song and think, ooh, I want to try to write something like that, you know? And I would like to try to do that more, because I think that can take your writing in a really fun place where, you know, you're using inspiration of another artist. You're not copying them, but you say, oh, I love their winding melody on that. What if I tried to write a winding melody, and you just have a little constraint and go from there?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of, you know, do you do many co-writes?
I do a few.
Okay.
I'd like to do more, but yeah.
Because I've had a lot of singer-songwriters that I've interviewed have told me how much they enjoy doing co-writes simply because, you know, well, I don't know if this is appropriate or not. Two heads can be better than one, but you get immediate feedback that you can bounce off, you know, your idea, and the other person could come back with, well, what if we did this, we did that, and so on. And I, you know, it's interesting to me, however, how even working singularly, you know, trying to find and think of how many different ways you could say the same thing. I suppose that's where what I always enjoy working with prose. I'm not much with being a poet, but in prosaic writing, always trying to find ways to say it differently. And in particularly in academic writing, always trying to be the most succinct and parsimonious and so forth, you know, without you know, too much verbiage. You try to be very, very to the point, so forth, and working with that. So I know that there's a craft involved, you know, in writing. Now, you mentioned that you were writing a song for a session. Do you write songs for other people?
No, it was for a session that I was asked to do as like a demo artist for a mentor of mine was actually teaching a university class through NYU, like a production engineering class, and she needed an artist to demo on, you know, how to produce, how to engineer. So I wanted something fresh for that.
Okay.
So no, I've written a commissioned song like for someone's personal use, like for a party, but not for sessions. Not
okay.
So far.
Yeah. Well, then so far, everything that you have written, is fair to say, has been for you and about you, in a sense.
Yeah, I guess some of the songs I've written have, you know, a character that's not necessarily me, but yes, they are for me or about my life or peripheral people in my life.
Okay. Well, that's always, when does inspiration typically hit? Do you ever see it coming, or does it just pop out of nowhere?
Usually pops out of nowhere.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember Claude Debussy, the French composer, used to say that inspiration and composition is like seeing a flash of lightning and then trying to reproduce what you saw.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I would like to work a little harder at just the practice of showing up. And, you know, it's like you're not going to strike gold every time. But I can be known to sort of just wait around for inspiration. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm inspired. I'm going to write another song. And, you know, I have some friends who are just such prolific writers that really show up consistently to their craft. And I would like to do that a bit more. But I also, as a musician, I identify as a songwriter and an artist, but also as a, instrumentalist and side person. And so I feel like I have my hands in a few different things, and that can split the energy sometimes, but also I love it because it also takes the pressure off of, you know, putting all your eggs in one basket.
So. Well, and you've got all these little tidbits of different experiences that contribute to, you know, wherever you want to put them. You can assemble your forces and go in a particular direction. I mean, it's I think there's a real advantage to that as well. Well, when you think about this last song that you wrote, what came first? Was it a melodic idea, a rhythmic idea, a particular set of chord changes? Was it the lyrics or a particular mood?
It was the sort of simultaneously the chord changes and melody that I was singing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting. And then you had to find lyrics to fit that.
Right. And so sometimes I'll do that and then sort of like, I'll be humming and then just see what words just come out naturally, what words fit the melodic rhythm. And I guess in that instance, that is what happened. And then I started singing, I've been trying to get this right. And then I'm like, what have I been trying to get right? Ask myself a few more questions. The lyrics sort of guide me to what I want to say.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. You're, I guess because you are an instrumentalist. I mean, a lot of, I'm not going to say most, but many of the singer-songwriters I've interviewed usually are, they start with lyrics. I made the joke to somebody once. I said, yeah, because it had been kind of a trend for a while. This was a couple of years ago when I was interviewing a number of singer-songwriters. And I said, they all seem to be English lit majors. And and they're all very much into writing words, and then they have to find the music to fit the words. But here you start with that musical aspects, and then find words to fit. And that's, you know, I guess that's the kind of the beauty too. You, even if you couldn't come up with a lyric, you could scat sing, you know. And that sounds like a kind of an interesting approach. And is there a particular mood I got the cart before the horse. All right, let me set up the question. When I taught music appreciation, and I, of course, the biggest question that my students would always ask me, particularly with classical music, if it's all instrumental, is, Dr. Hurst, what does it mean? What's it trying to tell us? And I'd say, well, first of all, think about it this way. When you close your eyes and you listen to the music, and it's, what's it the soundtrack for? What movie do you see in your head? Or ask yourself this question. When you're listening to this piece of music, what state of mind was the composer in? Was the composer happy? Were they sad? Had they just been jilted by their significant other? Had they witnessed horror, tragedy, you know, that sort of thing? So when we talk about, a particular mood of music, what particular moods tend to inspire you and that you feel like comes across in your music? Or is it a full range of emotions? I mean, I would suggest your album is a full range of emotions, but typically, what do you experience?
So the question is not the mood that I'm trying to portray, but the moods of other people's music that inspires me.
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
It's so interesting because the music that I really always come back to and love listening to is it's not even really like the music that I write. I love listening to Sufjan Stevens and Nick Drake and Jose Gonzalez, and iTunes used to put in this category called sadcore.
Sadcore.
And it's
okay.
Like, yeah, Really tender, quiet guitar finger picking and beautiful voice leading in the chords and soft vocals. And my brother writes a lot of music in that style, which I think is what introduced it me to it originally. So when I like more often than not, when I just want to chill and listen to music, I'll put on like my favorite, just almost, it's like a little bit depressing of music, but there's something about it that just feels so, it just holds you. And for a while, I think I put a lot of pressure on myself for my own music to communicate all sorts of things. I was like, oh, I wish I was a funnier songwriter, or that I could make people dance, or that my music was more political. And after doing more writing and, compiling a whole album, I've realized that my truest voice and a theme and a mood that seems pretty continuous despite the different genres, is a feeling of comfort and of hope and uplifting. And I think a few years ago I would have thought, oh, that's too basic. Like, I want my music to do more than that. But since releasing this album, I've had quite a few people reach out to me and share with me how much better it made them feel about something, or how much hope it gave them, or how uplifted they felt by songs that are drastically different sonically or genre-wise. But that's given me kind of a new sense of purpose and direction. And I have started to take the pressure off of like, okay, I'm not really a ballad writer who tells some super detailed story necessarily. And I'm not like a, I don't write the most on the nose political songs or the most like danceable songs all the time. But as long as I can write something that will make someone feel better, or help them cry, or help them feel like they don't need to lose hope, and that they can just, come back to themselves and trust themselves, then I think I'm doing what I want to do,
So
music.
you, from what I hear you saying, you feel like your music is both cathartic and healing. It helps people get the bad vibes out, and then helps, or the bad emotions out, and then helps kind of patch that up and make you feel better.
That is so succinct. Yes.
Well, you know, that's not so far removed from things I've heard. I remember from a documentary I used to show my jazz history class, oh my goodness, 25 years ago. It was on the blues, and in it there was an old blues musician, and he used to say, one way to get rid of the blues is to sing the blues. You know, because there's something about, sharing your feelings, your emotions, your whatever your basic essence as a human through music, that kind of cleanses your soul and makes you feel better, and it probably does that for listeners as well. And I think that music, well, I'm going to be careful, because I'll get on a soapbox and preach here, because I'm a music educator, so I believe in the power of music and all the benefits that it does for us. But so I won't go there, but I think that that's what you've described exactly as a real, not only cathartic, but a healing power that music has.
Yeah, absolutely. I love you can take my long, verbose answer and make it succinct. It's beautiful.
Well, which is a real turn of events for me, because usually what happens is when I have somebody tell me something, I'll say, well, but actually it could be blah, 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 blah. And then I go into my professor mode, and then I get a bad case of verbosity. It tends to happen, and habits are hard to break. I sometimes have people say, "You sure like to talk a lot." I says, "I know. I used to get paid by the word." Anyway, but I imagine that I was going to ask you probably a very obvious question, but do you keep a sketchbook of ideas or heads or vamps or musical ideas or lyric phrases, things like that?
I do my voice memos on my phone.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the new notebook. Yeah.
For me
Yeah.
especially, as someone who thinks often in music, either simultaneously with the words or before the words, gives me a great way to hum a little melody or idea, and then I have a little folder. Oh my God, my voice memos, they've been crashing every time I try to record something because I have, let's see how many I have.
Oh, my.
It's overrun. Let's see. 1,850.
Wow.
I clean it
But
out.
that's 1,850 potential great ideas.
Some of them are, rehearsals. I record the,
Yeah.
whatever I'm playing so I don't forget. But yeah, some of them are ideas.
Yeah, and I guess and I'm going to tell you something you probably already know. You never know when something that you have kind of thought of, oh, it'll never be nothing, finally becomes something. That's why it's if you were to look around in my office here, you would definitely see that I'm a cluttered person. And I'm not a hoarder per se, but I rarely throw things away because I'm just so afraid that I might find a use for them, because in the past I have, things that I thought were done for. Well, I assume that you are currently writing, aside from this one project that you're doing for this friend of yours, but that you're currently writing. Can you give us any kind of a sneak preview of what you're working on and what audiences might hear on future recordings or live shows? What kind of things are you working on?
I did just put out a new single at the end of January,
Oh.
and that one falls more in the country category. So anyone who loves like Americana, like fiddle sounds, I think would really like that. And the two songs from that session, I'm really excited to put out as singles at some point. One of them is the groovier one I mentioned that sort of has like a Lake Street Dive or like Fleetwood Mac feel to it. And the other one was produced in like this really like cinematic way with these really cool drums. I am obsessed with the show Outlander, which apparently a lot of like middle-aged women love. So I don't know what that says about me, but the opening music in the show is like this beautiful Scottish song, and it's got these like huge cinematic emphatic Scottish drums happening, and I was like joking around with my friends in the session like, come on, play like the Outlander drums, and the drummer Dom Billet gave me something kind of like the Outlander drums.
Okay.
It's really kind of cinematic song that I'm like, maybe I'll pitch this to some TV. Well, I don't know. So
Yeah.
I'm very excited to have those completed singles in the pocket. And funny enough, I am sort of at the moment like focusing. I'm really glad I got those singles recorded. And of course, I always have my little ideas that I'm putting down and writing bits and pieces of things, but I've been focusing a lot on side personing lately, and there's two projects that I've been pretty busy with in town. My friend Jake Byrne is putting out an album which we recorded last year, and we just played a show this week, and my friend Ava Swan is recording a new album next week, and we're in the midst of rehearsals right now, and I'm going to play keys and maybe some strings on that. So I'm really in my side person mode right now.
Okay, good. Getting some good studio work and experience. Good.
And I'm just loving supporting other people's songs, and I learned so much as a songwriter from learning other people's music from that perspective of being a supportive player rather than the main singer. So I have had just a lot of fun with that, and I have a lot more side person stuff coming up this year. Some of it I cannot talk publicly about at the moment, but I'm gonna have some new musical adventures coming up that aren't necessarily, they aren't my writing or my music, but I just love music. So any way I can be a part of music and be a part of anyone's project makes me feel excited and makes me feel like I'm doing what I...
You know, it must be a lot of fun. Now you're, as I understand, you're in Nashville.
I am.
And it must just be wonderful to be in an environment where you're surrounded by so many excellent musicians. And as I have come to interview numerous artists who are in Nashville, I've also come to learn about the diversity of music that is being produced in Nashville. It isn't just, you know, two kinds of music, or the both kinds of music, country and Western, that there's a strong Celtic music scene. There's a strong R&B scene. There's, you know, jazz scene. Of course, the Nashville Symphony is well known, things like that. And it must just be a wonderful, rich experience for you, even to go in and play as a side person on someone else's project, just because I have to imagine, I can only guess, what it just must be wonderful to be in the rarefied air of all these talented people in the confine of a studio and working together towards the creation of a work of art. I think that's probably, I know for myself, I think that'd be very fulfilling to be able to sit on a session like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, very beautifully said. I can only agree with what you said. And recently I have been having these feelings in these moments when I'm in a rehearsal or doing some tracking for someone or practicing for a session where I stop and I think, wow, I'm doing it. I'm a professional musician, you know, and that has felt extremely fulfilling. I've done a lot of teaching as well in my life. That is so fulfilling as well. Though recently I have transitioned away from that to make time to, you know, just be doing the performing and writing and recording full time. And that is a new territory for me. And it has been just exciting to stop and think, wow, okay, yeah, this is my day and this is my life. And I felt really grateful lately, and Nashville is just a really wonderful place to live. And I just loved being here ever since I moved here, and everyone is so welcoming. And as you said, it's just pretty cool to be surrounded by so many people that inspire you and push you to, you know, to be better. And
I can just envision what it must be like to be in that environment. The closest I can come to is when I was in graduate school, and I was at the University of North Texas, and of course a huge music school, and you're just surrounded by wonderful, and not just a few, but lots and lots and lots of very talented people who are all have the goal in mind to learn how to make great music. And you're just, you know, you could put together a pickup band just from walking the halls of the music building, and it would be really a good group, you know, I mean, that sort of thing. And so it's, yeah, it's nice. And it's fun too. I know, you know, when you get to work or perform with people that you feel like you can trust musically. Other ways aren't bad either, but at least when you can trust them musically, that if you play a particular way, they know what to do to back you up or to carry it forth, you know, that sort of thing. It's an indescribable experience that I cannot put into words for a musically lay person. I just can't find a way to describe it. I just know it is.
Yeah. And I also, I just love, like, a lot of my friends are musicians, and I grew up going to some old time and bluegrass festivals, and those were always just the best part of the year. You know, they were like Christmas, and I always dreamed of living a life that was more like just being at a festival all the time. And this is it's pretty darn close, and I love just being surrounded by people who love to play music.
There you have it.
Yeah.
Yep, I'm right there with you. I know it's just a wonderful thing. Well, Nina, I always like to try to get back to people's origin stories. So I have the next questions I have for you are who or what turned the light on for you? What turned you on to music and becoming a musician?
I have to say that it was my dad. And I mean, both my parents have played a just enormous role in me being able to pursue music. And my dad is a multi-instrumentalist, and he and my mom would always have their friends over for campfires growing up. And my friends and I would run around and lay on blankets and fall asleep listening to them play, you know, old time music or old, folk standards. And apparently, when I was maybe, I think I was 4, I said to my mom, "I want to learn to play the violin so I can fiddle around the campfire with dad." And so that is like the earliest thing that I can trace back to, like the reasoning behind why. And that's been clarified even more recently because my sister had a beautiful baby. He's like 3 and a half now, but I've had a chance to see my parents with their first grandchild. And the way my dad plays with him is it's so awesome to see. He'll put a guitar on his lap, facing up, and hold Luca and play it right there where Luca can be looking at the strings and watching it. And I'm like, oh my God, no wonder I became a musician. Like that's probably what he did to me too. Just a lot of like musical nurturing, and my mom took us to just so many music lessons growing up. I studied violin and piano classically. And so she was always just extremely supportive, and I can't even fathom the amount of hours she spent driving us around and sitting and waiting for us to do our lessons.
While you're taking your lessons, sure. Yeah, well, I have a hearing you speak very similar experience. Probably not so much that my father, held me on his knee and played guitar because he didn't play guitar, but he did give me my first trumpet lesson. So I have to give my dad credit there. But I know we always had music around the house. We sang when we were in the car. We did that, and lots of seems like lots of recordings. I mean, I grew up listening to, Broadway musicals and big band music and that was it's funny how those things kind of instill. And then I can remember when our family bought a Baldwin organ. And my dad played. He knew how to play and he would and I thought, oh, that's really kind of cool. And initially, my aspirations were to play the organ at the baseball park, da 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 da, that sort of thing, right? I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. And so anyway, but one day my mom said, if you're going to play it, you're going to learn how to play it right. So when I was about this one, I was about 9, so started me on lessons, and then I picked up the trumpet later. But yeah, it's really amazing how that light can get turned on for us. And a lot of times it's because of parental encouragement. And my parents always stood behind me in all my endeavors. And even though my dad played a little bit, my mom some too, but never, at a professional level or anything. So that's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, I think that that parental influence is very important. Well,
Yeah.
yeah, go. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I guess I also have to add that my oldest sister, she started a band and started touring when I was in sixth or seventh grade. And seeing her pursue music while I was in middle school, I kind of saw that and thought, oh, wow, this is like a viable career and thing to do. And she actually ended up moving to Nashville, and I came later. So I can't discount her inspiration to me as well.
That's wonderful. Well, that's wonderful. Well, let's shift gears for just a little bit. You know, the great jazz trumpet player Clark Terry once said that, you know, first you imitate, then you assimilate, then you innovate. So I have two questions for you in that regard. Who has informed your style of singing? And who has informed your vocal quality? In other words, your vocal instrument.
So the first one, I remember from a young age, I loved Nora Jones. And I think possibly also because I could hear myself in her a little bit, you know, that more airy tone. And she's a voice that I, you know, really would try to emulate as like a teenager. More recently, I have taken more vocal classes and was lucky enough to get to study with Rachel Price in Lake Street Dive. And she also is one of my favorite vocalists ever. Someone that I hadn't heard my voice in before, but after studying with her, learned some, or took away some tools and some ways to open up my voice and sing in a stronger capacity on songs like Wrong Thing, you know, sing a little more forward, a little more resonant, instead of so chill and airy. So I think her mode of singing, as well as having the chance to study with her a little bit, informed my vocal palette and some of the tools that I'm able to pull from there. Yeah, so those are two very obvious ones for me. Did that answer both questions or not?
Well, it kind of does, I guess. You know, it's sort of like, I'm always kind of curious as to, you know, what has gone into making up your musical DNA. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of like a different way, I guess, of asking, you know, the typical question, what do you consider to be your most prominent influences? You know, who influenced you? You know, and I like to kind of couch that a little bit differently, because I do believe, just like you're talking about with your, you know, studying voice helped to shape your vocal quality. I would say that my tone on trumpet is very much dependent, or at least owed to my trumpet teacher, because, you know, he would play in our lessons. And of course, that would inform my ear about the particular quality of sound to make on the trumpet. And, you know, I think with music, it's very much kind of a, I think we do imitate, at least, you know, for starters, we have to start somewhere. And so I'm always kind of curious about that. But no, I think Nora Jones, now I think about it, I do hear a bit of that in your voice. You're, you know, and is your voice classification, are you a mezzo or an alto?
So it's funny you should ask this. My perception of this has been changing a little recently. When I was in choir, I was an alto one.
Okay.
And I sort of fought my teacher on that in high school. I was like, put me with the alto twos or even the tenors. Like, I sing really low. Come on. And he was like, your natural range is higher than you think it is. And I just recently started with a new sort of vocal therapist coach. And she has been helping me reach even into a higher, like, soprano two range. Notes that I used to just, like, in high school, if you would have told me I would be singing like a D above middle, like a D4, I would have been like, oh my God, absolutely not, never. You know, it was like hard for me to reach a G above middle C. But I would say my most comfortable range these days is alto one, and I'm also exploring a soprano two range and finding that that is more sustainable for me when singing harmonies, because I can't sing those notes unless I'm singing with good technique, right? And you
Exactly.
can get away with bad technique in a lower range. And so that's just been a really neat discovery for me as I invest more in my voice, which is sort of a newer thing for me. As I told you, I was an instrumentalist first, and I'm sort of catching up with my voice.
Well, I find it's like when I listen to your recording, when I listen to your album, and of course, subconsciously you're always making kind of comparisons. Or not qualitative, but more just like, oh, she kind of sounds like. And I would suggest, and this is, of course, I'm not a vocalist, so take this for what it's worth or not worth, but your voice has a certain heft to it. It's not a wimpy little voice. It's got some heft. It's got some meat on the bones. Now, I wouldn't say that you are as dark or hefty as a Cassandra Wilson or Sarah Vaughan, but to me, the sound has that certain smokiness, heft kind of to it that suggests those artists. And I was last night, my wife and I have started, we've gotten hooked on this show on HBO called True Detective. And last night, which I highly recommend because the music for the whole series is T-Bone Walker. He does all the produces the music. But last night we started watching the third season, and the opening credits is to Cassandra Wilson singing the song Death Letter, which is an old blues song. And it was just so cool. And but she has Cassandra Wilson has that really smoky, hefty kind of alto, second alto kind of voice. I'm not saying that's you, but I think that you're kind of headed in that sort of direction based on what I've heard on your recording. So, but if you're expanding your range in the other direction, there's nothing wrong with that either.
I guess it depends on my role as a singer. I think when I am singing lead, I love that alto range, and the higher singing is sort of a cool tool for harmony singing, that it's like, most people aren't singing lead in that soprano range anyway. Maybe sopranos who sing lead are gonna sing the melody down a little bit lower, just because that's where most melodies sit. But yeah, I've actually received that comparison before, and I think that's cool, and I agree. It's, I think I don't have quite that depth of richness of
Heft. Yeah.
alto, but I love that comparison. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, see, another singer that I admire is Renee Fleming, who is a soprano with the Metropolitan Opera. But when she was in college at let's see, was she at Hart? I can't remember right now, all of a sudden. But anyway, it's when she was in college, she used to sing cabaret, to make money on the side. So anyway, a few years ago, she came out with an album of cabaret songs. And she talked about how purposely she puts them in a lower, she sings them in a lower key than what she usually sings as an operatic soprano. And I thought, isn't this so cool that she has this instrument that she can have this variability with? And it sounds like maybe you're heading in that direction as well. Maybe you're going to find a voice that's been within you all this time that you've never discovered, and that will really aid to your expression and your creativity, as well, of course, as still relying on on what you already have. I think that's wonderful to explore that. Well, I have a question to ask you now that most everybody I interview says is one of the hardest questions I ask. So hold on, here goes. What have been some of the most memorable moments from your career in music?
Yeah, that is really hard. There are so many beautiful moments. I would say what's fresh on the brain right now is my album release tour from August, and that was extremely special and memorable because I routed it through all of the cities that I have lived in, like Philly and Boston and Lancaster, where I grew up, and also some places in the Midwest that I haven't lived, but I have really good friends. And every single one of those shows was just so rewarding, because I haven't taken my solo music on the road that much, and especially not with a full band. And it was a big feat for me to put together that entire tour and be paying everyone in the band and lodging everyone, feeding everyone, and just being in charge of all of those logistics. And so every night when we would get to the actual show, the actual playing the music and seeing who came out to the show and getting to go to the merch table and talk to them afterwards, like those moments have really stuck with me and really just like fill me up. I love to think back on them. And like I was really worried that in Philly, I wasn't going to get a good showing. I went to school there in Philadelphia, but I've just heard from tour musicians it's like hard to get people out in Philly. And there was a really great showing, and that was the day that my album actually came out. And I was like, oh man, what if like nobody comes and this venue is like, why did we book her and all this stuff? And but it was like the perfect amount of people came, and it just felt so full circle to be back in the city that I had gone to college in and had kind of a hard time in. Like I didn't love living there in college, but it just felt so special to be back. And one more actually I have to mention is
That's all right.
when I went to Boston and played at Club Passim, I have these two different families that I taught online on Zoom for since before the pandemic all the way until this past January. And it's two sisters in each family, ranging from age from like 7 or 8 up to like 13. And the one family I hadn't even ever met in person, we met online and I gave them their COVID tutoring and lessons and everything. And that night was the first time I met this family and these sisters, Ashley and Veronica, in person. And then these other sisters, Maylene and Bo Yi, came to the show with their parents, and I had them all come up on stage and sing a song. And that was one of the last shows of the tour too. And I was like crying at the end. It was so special to share the stage with some students that I love so much.
Oh,
And yeah, so
that's one.
beautiful.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing those. A lot of people out there think that we go into music to make money. They forget what they don't know is we really go into music because of the relationships that it develops with other people, and how much we treasure those. And your story made me think about a couple of years back. I was playing a solo with the Civic Band during our summer concert series, and after one night I had a solo that I played with the band. I think I played the toy trumpet or something by Leroy Anderson, and afterward, one of our clarinetists came up with her 5-year-old daughter. And she said, "Would it be all right if Lexi says something to you?" And I said, "Well, of course." And the little girl came up and she said, "My favorite part of the concert was your trumpet playing." And
Oh.
I just about fell apart. hearing that from this little 5-6 year old girl, that what I had done had moved her. And I was just, so that's to all you out listening out there, the music, being in music isn't always about making money. Yeah, we have to survive, but it's really more about what we do with and for people. And I think that's really a wonderful story, Nina. I thank you for sharing it, because it certainly moved me to remember my story.
Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of, you know, you've had some students. What do you tell people who are aspiring toward a performing career in music?
I would tell anyone who wants to have a career in music to just follow what excites you the most in music. Like, I've wasted some time comparing myself to what other people are doing and, you know, trying to learn things or get good at things that maybe don't totally suit me. And it's always cool in life to look back at how you got where you are. And in hindsight, of course, follow the breadcrumbs. And I feel like a lot is coming into alignment for me in this last year, in particular in Nashville. And really the things that led me here are like following those little voices inside that like may seem kind of random at the time. Like a few years ago, I got really into the mandolin and was like, I'm going to start like practicing the mandolin. Like, I want to be a mandolin player. I'm going to buy a mandolin so that I'm a mandolin player. And funny enough, like some new stuff that I'm going to be doing this year, like I have to be able to play the mandolin. And I'm like, wow, like, who knew this was going to be so useful to me? And it's like, I didn't learn it because I thought I was going to need it. I learned it because I just love mm-hmm. the instrument, right? Mm-hmm. And so following those things that you love, I think will undoubtedly lead you to the right places. And that's the biggest thing I could say. Mm-hmm. And just to, like, I really have found that living somewhere where I'm surrounded by a great community of mm-hmm. people and musicians has helped a lot. Mm-hmm. And I really recommend that, not necessarily Nashville, but, you know, being somewhere where you feel like mm-hmm. you can really be yourself musically mm-hmm. and where you can push yourself too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important part of it. Like, I wouldn't want to live somewhere that wasn't challenging me. And I think living in Nashville has led me to some opportunities that I maybe or surely wouldn't have gotten if I lived somewhere else. Probably would have gotten some other opportunities. You know, that's how life is.
Well, I think you speak to something that's really true. It helps a lot when you're in a supportive environment. And I think another thing musically lay people don't always understand is that, at least this has been my experience, is that in the musical community, you find people that are really much more supportive than competitive. It is a competitive business. There's no doubt about it. But the competition isn't so much about putting other people down. It's just about making yourself the best you can be.
Absolutely.
And being in that community helps motivate you to do that.
Absolutely. And it's funny you say that. I was just talking to a new friend last night about that, someone who moved from LA and was a little nervous about Nashville and, mm-hmm. you know, the competitiveness of the music industry. And I was like, I was worried about the same thing, but I have found only open, gracious arms here and people who want to connect you to who they know and help you out in whatever way they can. And it's been just like so beautiful to see and be a part of that and to realize like, oh yeah, we're all in this together. And a quote that I've heard recently that I really love is, a high tide raises all ships. And it's like, mm-hmm. your friend got some great record deal. Like, you know, that is like amazing for them and everyone. It's just like a good thing is happening to someone in the community. And, you know, the more that happens, the more like everyone is gonna succeed and feel fulfilled, I think.
I'm right there with you. And I know in real artist communities, that's typically the way it is, or that's been my experience. So, you know, when you talked about the mandolin, I happen to think of a couple of things, and you know, I live near Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm about 30 minutes to the west of Lake Michigan, and I'm about an hour and a half northwest of Chicago. So it kind of gives you an idea. But anyway, Milwaukee, we're always kind of in Chicago's shadow, but Milwaukee's a very musically vibrant town in that, and I want you to consider this as an invitation to come to Milwaukee, because I'd be remiss if I didn't. But Milwaukee has a festival in the summer called Summerfest, and it is the largest outdoor music festival in the world. And they will have numerous stages, and they book artists who are at various different levels. We have huge internationally known acts and people who are just regionally known and people that so forth. And, you know, you can go online and find out more about Summerfest and see if that's something that might fit into your agenda. The other is that Milwaukee has some wonderful, I guess what I would call them, nice mid-sized venues, you know, that might take 250 to 300 people. There's Shank Hall, there's Collectivo Coffee, there's a number of really nice rooms that are always, I think, looking for, you know, for good entertainment and so I would extend an invitation to you to kind of check some of those out, have your management, you know, see if it's worth, you know, taking a trip. Because I can tell you from Nashville, you can get to Milwaukee in about 6 hours. Because I know I've driven from Waukesha to Nashville on my way to Atlanta. And I know that it's usually about, depending on traffic, 6 to 8 hours. But then also, once you get here, then there's Madison, Wisconsin. And Madison tends to be a very eclectic town musically. And they have some nice rooms and theaters over there to play. And then, of course, you're about, then from Madison, about 5 hours up the road to the Twin Cities. And so the Midwest has a good deal of things going on and I think opportunities for musicians like yourself, you know, to bring their music to what would be, I think, an eager audience. So consider me extending a arms of welcome to come to Wisconsin and the Midwest and check us out.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, yes, I tell you what, I'd be remiss if I didn't. but see, Milwaukee is called the City of Festivals, because during the summer we have Summerfest, but then we also have all of these different festivals, because, you know, Milwaukee is predominantly German and Polish, and then Italian, every year we have Polish Fest, we have a Festa Italiana, we have the largest German fest outside of Germany. And there's, of course, the music and so forth, that those events tends to be specific to those cultures and whatnot. But there's also other numerous opportunities for musicians. And like I said, some of the rooms that are up here, these sort of like what I call mid-size places, they're not huge arenas, but they're nice places to perform and listen to music. Well, I can't say I've never performed at any of them, but I have gone to hear some groups. Most of my performing's been in smaller nightclubs, but jazz clubs, you know, which are usually always intimate and nice and dark, you know, like a jazz club should be. But anyway, so conversely, if I were to be able to drive down to Nashville in the next few weeks, where might I hear you play?
Well, I am. The only thing I have on the books right now is playing with my friend Ava Swan after we record her album.
Okay.
The music is incredible, and we're playing at the Blue Room on the 17th. And I just love her music, and I'm sure you all will too. And yeah, I haven't booked stuff for myself, because of kind of what I mentioned earlier, some upcoming things that I am going to be busy practicing for. So
Okay.
you follow me on, social media and all that stuff, you'll see all of those things come to light eventually, and you'll see where I'll be playing and stuff like that. But right now, it's the Blue Room with Ava Swan is the next thing.
Wonderful. That's excellent. That's on the 17th of February. Oh, okay. Well, I wish I could get down there, but I think I'm busy that night. But hey, there'll be other times, and maybe
It will.
sometime you'll come up here and you remember this face, and maybe you'll see me in your audience. That'd be fun. That would be a lot of fun. Well,
Oh, that would.
you know, Nina, I try to be as thorough as I can be when I try to put together questions to ask a guest, but I know I'm not perfect. So, Nina, is there anything else you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
I don't think so. I think you asked just such excellent questions. We covered so many bases. This has
Okay.
been a lot of fun. And yeah, I just thank anyone who's made it this far for listening, and hope to see you all out there on the road.
Well, wonderful. Well, I appreciate the compliment. I try to put some work into what I do and take some pride in it. And it's just something I started, and now it's a hobby that's kind of become obsessive. So, but
Follow
mostly,
your excitement and your passion.
well, mostly I do it because I like to talk to other musicians, you know, like yourself, and find out what's going on in your world, and it always lifts me up to hear about it. But Nina, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking time to talk with me today, and I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a successful musical future.
Thank you so much. I really very much appreciate you having me on. It's a wonderful podcast, and I'm so grateful. So thank you.
You're very welcome, and you have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Okay. My discovery composer of the week is Lukas Foss. Born in Berlin, August 15, 1922, he died in New York, February 1st, 2009. He began studies in piano and theory in Berlin with Julius Goldstein. From 1933 to 1937, he was in Paris, where he studied piano with Lazare Levy, composition with Noel Gallen, orchestration with Felix Wolffs, and flute with Louis Moyse. Having moved to the United States with his family in 1937, he continued his study at the Curtis Institute, where his teachers included Rosario Scalero and Randall Thompson. He studied conducting with Fritz Reiner and with Sergei Koussevitzky during summers at the Berkshire Music Center. He was also a special student with Powell Hindemith at Yale. Foss began to compose at the age of 7, and at 22, he won wide acclaim for his secular cantata, The Prairie, on Carl Sandburg's poem. This work received the New York Music Critics Circle Award. From 1944 to 1950, Foss was pianist in the Boston Symphony, and in 1945, he became the youngest composer ever to receive a Guggenheim Fellowship. In 1950 to 1951, he was a fellow of the American Academy in Rome, and in 1950 to 1952, the recipient of a Fulbright grant. His international reputation was enhanced with the premiere of his Piano Concerto No. 2 in Venice, premiered on October 7, 1951. He was the soloist. In February 1953, Foss was appointed professor of music at the University of California, Los Angeles, where in 1957 he founded the Improvisation Chamber Ensemble. While living in California, he was music director at the Ojai Festival. He was elected to the National Institute of Arts and Letters in 1962. From 1963 to 1970, He was music director and conductor of the Buffalo Philharmonic. In 1963, at State University New York, Buffalo, he founded the Center for Creative and Performing Arts, which presented concerts of new music. In 1971, he was appointed conductor of the Brooklyn Philharmonia, and from 1972 to 1976, served as conductor of the Kol Israel Orchestra of Jerusalem. In Brooklyn, Foss began Meet the Moderns, a series of new music concerts and discussions with composers. In 1981, while continuing to hold his Brooklyn post and live in New York, Foss became music director of the Milwaukee Symphony, a position he retained until 1986. His tenure with the Brooklyn Philharmonic ended in 1990 when he was appointed conductor laureate. In his later years, Foss appeared as a guest conductor with many orchestras in the United States and Europe, lectured widely at colleges and universities in North America, and continued to compose. He joined the faculty of Boston University in 1991 and directed the Music Festival of the Hamptons from 1997 to 2006. Foss was awarded the Gold Medal for Music from the American Academy of Arts and Letters in 2000. The Lucas Foss Collection at the Library of Congress holds manuscripts of published and unpublished compositions, correspondence, and other personal and business papers. Foss's development as a composer may be divided into three main periods. The first period, 1944 to 1960, was predominantly neoclassical and eclectic, represented by such works as the Symphony in G, the early concertos, various choral works, and the orchestral Symphony of Chorales, based on chorales by Bach. Also present is an element of American populism, as in the setting of Sandburg's The Prairie and the comic opera The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, on the story by Mark Twain. A transitional phase began in 1956, when Foss decided to experiment with ensemble improvisation, primarily for the benefit of his students at the University of California, Los Angeles. A year later, he founded the Improvisation Chamber Ensemble and formulated what he called system and chance music, a kind of controlled improvisation. This experience led to a profound change in Foss's compositional techniques. He abandoned tonality and fixed forms and opted for serialism, interdeterminacy, and graphic notation. A transitional work, Time Cycle, won the New York Music Critics Circle Award of 1961 and has remained Foss's most performed and recorded work. Equi, for four soloists, marks the definitive beginning of the experimental phase. Three works of this period, Elettres, Fragments of Archilochos, and For 24 Winds, are based on the idea of a score containing on every page a sum total from which a different selection is extracted for each performance. Baroque Variations includes a surrealistic element in that the variations are dreams in which the original music is fragmented and distorted. The surrealism pervades Variation 3, Forion, on Bach's Partita in E for solo violin. The autobiographical suggestions in Forion become explicit in Curriculum Vitae with Time Bomb, while an accordion plays themes remembered from Foss's own childhood, a Hungarian dance by Brahms, Mozart's Turkish March, the Nazi anthem, etc. Percussion ominously ticks off a countdown. The final explosion, however, turns out to be a gentle pop from a child's cap pistol. With the more conservative musical taste of the 1980s and 90s, Foss revisited the neoclassicism and Americana of his first period, composing again in traditional instrumental and choral genres, but not forgetting the experimental techniques of his second period. In his American Cantata of 1976, he strove to be as crazy as I was in my avant-garde music and yet tonal. His guitar concerto, American Landscapes, combines folk guitar styles and tunes with novel plucking and percussion techniques in the solo part. Similarly, in the wistful and antiquarian Renaissance Concerto, the solo flute's key clicks add percussive effect. These later works present music that is frank in sentiment, imaginative in an almost pictorial way, and yet refined and witty in execution. For all their diverse styles, Foss's works spring from a distinct personality. Enthusiastic, curious, and receptive to every kind of musical idea. Not coincidentally, these are the same attitudes he instilled in audiences with his performances of the classical repertory and new music. In short, he was one of his era's most communicative and representative composer-performers. Foss's discography is vast, with recordings of his original music as well as his work as a pianist and conductor. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube performance of Foss's Symphony No. 1 in G, performed by the Stanford Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Paul Phillips. Well, that wraps episode 178. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I will be interviewing New York-based pianist, composer, and educator Kaylee O'Doherty, currently on the faculty of the State University New York Purchase. Other upcoming interviews include Melbourne, Australia-based jazz tenor saxophonist Anton Deleka, Minneapolis-based jazz singer Leslie Vincent, and Nashville-based singer-songwriter Ava Swanson. So don't touch that dial. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.